We're going to start off with a quiz, just to see where the audience is at and everything. And that is, how many people remember the term Lacey? How many people remember the word AgriStars? All that means is you people are old. Those are some of the original projects that started utilizing Lacey, stood for Large Area Crop Inventory Experiment, and basically was some of the original pieces that were done to start utilizing agricultural remotes or remote sensing for agricultural purposes to identify crop areas, a number of different pieces that go with this. And if you look back at a number of different things, it really, in the 70s, we were enamored by the pretty pictures that we could get out of remote sensing, out of Landsat and everything else. Fast forward to 2016, we're still enamored by the pretty maps that we get out of remote sensing. And I believe that we have some challenges in how do we begin to think about the utilization of that information to monitor and assess agricultural systems as we go forward. And so my goal today is to give you a little bit of history, but I'm also going to challenge you into where we need to be thinking about all of this as we go forward from this dynamic. I'll just give you a little bit of history of this. I'll start out with the electromagnetic spectrum so everybody is all on the same wavelength, no pun intended. You knew I was going to do that, didn't you, Ray? We'll talk a little bit about reflectance of leaves, what that means, how we took that reflectance aspect and put it into vegetative indices, how those have been applied to agriculture, and then where the world, according to Hatfield, is really about some challenges and opportunities. And the rest of the speakers that follow are going to give you their perspective on challenges and opportunities as well, in terms of some of these dynamics from this standpoint. If you look at this whole electromagnetic spectrum, we go all the way from gamma rays to radio waves. We've got shorter frequencies, higher frequencies, and for those people who skipped that day in physics class, these are some of the dynamics that go on in all of this. But if you really boil it down and start looking at what we have within the vegetative characteristics, we're really talking about the visible near-infrared part of the spectrum. Just give you a couple of classics, green vegetation, dry vegetation, soil in terms of lines across the visible and some of the near IR and SWIR bands that are in there, and then whether they're stressed and not stressed, a number of different things that happen with this. And if you go back and you begin to look at the literature, and I'm talking about the literature in the 60s and the 70s with Gaussman and some of those, where they look very closely at individual leaves and the reflectance spectra on that, stacked leaves, looked at diseased leaves, healthy leaves, all of that. That's some of the trademark work that set the stage for how we really begin to look at remote sensing. And I would urge you, if you haven't done that, to go back and look at some of that original literature, because it does give you insights into what we've done on this. One of the problems that we have in remote sensing is that we never go back and look at the history of some of the vegetative indices in all of this. And I'll point out my particular bias on a few of those as we go along. We've got the visible near infrared, SWIR bands, everything, and then we've got thermal that we've used in remote sensing, wavelengths that's 6 to 25 micrometers, but it basically is emission is a function of temperature. What we see in those particular wavelengths is how warm that body is. So all of us, if we could see in that thermal regime, all of us in this audience would be glowing. We would be glowing at different levels, and that's what we pick up with the thermal, is we actually pick up what we emit out of this. So the sun, 6,000 degrees, It emits a lot of energy, emits in those wavelengths, and it's the principle that's really behind all the infrared thermometers, is that we can take and back calculate from the energy that we capture in that device and put it back using that simple formula to what temperature is really at the what that surface temperature is we're observing. And we've captured and utilized that for long periods of time as well. So here's a brief history in six viewpoints in terms of the remote sensing relative to agriculture. If you go back and you look at that original literature that was in a number of different papers, those visual differences in plant leaves could be related to nutrient deficiency, disease, age of that leaf, a number of different things that happened. There were tools that were developed that actually begun to measure the reflectance of leaves or canopies. We went from a leaf in a lab to a canopy in a field to putting that on a different piece. There was a lot of handheld radiometers, tractor-mounted radiometers, and all of this, and you can just look at the progression of how we've mounted instruments and built robust instruments. With the launch of Landsat 4, with four different wave bands, it began the extension to plant identification. That was LASI, really trying to look at how much corn there was, soybeans, wheat, a number of different crops on a U.S. basis as well as a worldwide basis. And how do we begin to look at that? And it just kind of exploded after that from that standpoint. And now we have those in that original four bands. And now we have hyperspectral. We've had 100-plus wave bands, wavelengths, wave bands of 1 to 2 microns, very fine. We swim in data. However, the question and challenge remains, have we increased our information content in what we've been trying to assess relative to agriculture? There's been a rapid expansion, and yesterday with the UAV symposium, we've had this rapid expansion or explosion of drones, aircraft. They've continued to increase the interest in the use of remote sensing from lots of different viewpoints, looking at field variation, looking at all the different patterns within the field, trying to determine where that gets put into the management piece of all of this, and how do we begin to utilize this information. But at some stage, we're still at this awe of the map, the awe of the colors that we have when we can see field variation that's out there. So the question remains, have we really progressed in the value of remote sensing to detect agricultural or agronomic parameters in the last 40-plus years? Have we really gone beyond some of the things that we originally did in AgriStars and LASI and all of this? If you look at this reflectance piece, here's the range of the eye. We only really see a very narrow part of that electromagnetic spectrum. We see black, we see blues, we see greens, we see reds, but we don't see anything in the near infrared. If you look at where we've been with all the Landsat bands, is that we're still in a small portion of this, and we could divide all those hyperspectral pieces out there as well from that standpoint. If you just look at a canopy throughout the year in wave bands that go from the visible to the SWIR bands, you see this trends in time over the whole growing season from the time it's planted until it's harvested again. Seeing a lot of change in the near-infrared, things that happen in the SWIR bands. I just contrast the conventional versus a strip-till system. Most of that is at the end of the season with crop residue management. Once that crop is out there, you really don't see the soil surface below that from that standpoint. So you begin to see a lot of different things that go on in this. We begin to look at these dynamics. I'll just flip it around and look at canola in this, in terms of getting that near infrared as the plant grows. We're reflecting more and more of the near infrared. We're absorbing more of the greens and the reds as well. That allows us to begin to do things with the vegetative indices from that standpoint. So the vegetative indices, if you go back and start looking at this, and you can go back into the history of all of this, that basically people begin to draw different pieces together and say, aha, I can do things relative to biomass, leaf area, ground cover, light interception, chlorophyll, senescence, whatever parameter that you want out there. They've been related to these different vegetative indices. And actually, that list hasn't really changed much in the last 40 years. We've manipulated them different ways. Rick will talk about how we put it into looking at ET and a number of different things, but drawing combinations together from that standpoint. The first index that was out there is that shift that we get between near-infrared and red was basically that simple ratio of what we do with that. It was related to biomass and really biomass during the vegetative stage. And this is just a plot of that near-infrared over red index throughout the season. Get a really nice relationship, and then as that plant begins to mature and senesce, that changes, but it's no longer related to total biomass of that plant. So you have to be very cautious about what portion of the phenological system that index is really related to in a lot of different ways. And we tend to use these vegetative indices and think about these vegetative indices as being applicable throughout the whole growing season. But in reality, they're often not. Here's just some of the favorite ones that are out there. Light interception is NDVI, near-infrared divided by near-infrared plus red, just a simple ratio. It is probably the most used index in literature that exists. It is the most misused index in the literature, and I'll show you why that is. The senescence index, it's a red-green over near-infrared, and I'll show you that change in time. It's been around since the late 70s. It's probably the least used index in looking at how plants senesce at the end of the season, but has a lot of power in that. Leaf structure, leaf chlorophyll, biomass, leaf area index, savvy and everything else. A lot of us that collect these data compute anywhere from 35 to 45 different indices in looking at combinations of different things that are going on from this standpoint. There was a rapid development of indices. If you look back at the history during the 70s, almost every issue of the remote sensing journals had a new index. And then we've... Ray's laughing because some of us. How many people developed an index in their career besides Ray and I and Craig Daughtry in the back, Charlie? A lot of us have been responsible for developing indices in all of this, so we have a great chuckle about this. Maybe that's our legacy to science, is confusing the world. I just point out the normalized difference vegetative index. It's probably the most widely used. It's the most misused. It's related to leaf area biomass. I mean, that's what you see in the literature. People try to relate it to leaf area index, biomass, ground cover, yield, almost any plant parameter. Tries to get related to NDVI. But here's the way it behaves during the season. It reaches a plateau somewhere about 0.8 to 0.85. This is different tillage systems. This is a single tillage. If you go back and look, NDVI is related to light interception most appropriately. It is truly related to how efficient that plant is at capturing light. And that's really where it needs to be used from that standpoint. Now, light interception is determined by LAI, a number of different things. But everybody says, well, you know, my NDVI index reaches 0.8 and I'm trying to relate it to LAI and it's no longer has a relationship. Well, that's because it saturates at an LAI of 4. And a lot of our crops go to LAIs of 8, 9, and the NDVI is saturated at that point. And you just look at the physics of when canopies behave, and you begin to see that that's why that relationship behaves the way it does. And so here's your word of caution to you. If you go in, write a paper, NDVI related to leaf area index, related to NDVI, and it gets sent to me as a reviewer, it's going to get rejected straight off. I can tell you that because I read a lot of papers and look at them. And if you're trying to misuse an index and it gets rejected, you can probably send me an email and say, did you review that paper? I just have certain biases because I've become a grumpy old guy in relative to some of the indices that are out there. We can do better, guys. We can do much better than what we have. And so then, as you look at the whole progression of remote sensing, this is where we've kind of gone to. We started out, we began to look at vegetative characteristics, and then all of a sudden we discovered, oh, plants are growing on top of soil. And not all soils are the same. So now we had to go back and adjust for soils. And so there's a great body of literature, if you look through this whole piece. All of a sudden we have vegetative indices, and then we started adjusting them for soil background and whether the water content was the soil. And so then there was this plethora of indices called the soil adjusted vegetative index, and you know we fit lines to it, and then we transformed that soil adjusted vegetative index a little bit farther to put different regression lines to it. This is the way SABI looks during the season. It behaves a lot like a normalized vegetative difference index from the standpoint of really what's happening. And then you got perpendicular vegetative index. You got enhanced vegetative index. We've had chlorophyll indices, near infrared over green. This is related to leaf chlorophyll content. Red edge chlorophyll index. A normalized pigment chlorophyll index. You know, just to point out the fact that we in remote sensing are very imaginative in terms of how combining wavelengths and what we can do with them as well. And on, we've related SABI to LAI, EVI to LAI, and red-green to LAI. You see the different shapes throughout the whole growing season and when it behaves. You know, this is the accumulating stage. You know, that's not too bad. You know, it just depends on the shape of the curve that you want and the goodness of fit. Here's different indices relative to leaf area index, showing that you see different relationships and different characteristics. And those differences between those are the soil background lines from that standpoint. Soil vegetative index, if you look at it relative to leaf area index, it saturates at about that 4 level. And so we're not getting a lot of sensitivity. You know, if you really want it during that initial phase of growth, it's very robust. If you really want to look at light leaf area accumulation beyond total light interception, a lot of our indices start falling apart because we're saturating that signal in terms of the wavelengths that we're looking at from that standpoint. But during the growth phase, where we're accumulating up to full light interception, we get a pretty good relationship. It depends upon what segment of the growing season is being evaluated. And we try to apply it over the whole growing season, but we need to be very specific relative to a specific growth stage. We get strong relationships during the vegetative growth period, not so much during the grain filling period in a lot of this, during the reproductive stage from that standpoint. We can do some things with ground cover. You know, we've looked at all this. A lot of people will build on that. Craig Dowtry has built indices that actually look at the amount of residue that's out there, the residue cover, the type of cover, and all of this. Here's just an application of NDVI. This is a sequence of NDVI relative to light interception, and we've used it to compute how much light is captured by that canopy throughout the season. And it's very good for that. And we've taken and used that to be able to compute radiation use efficiency. And so it does tell us how efficient that light is at capture, or that canopy is at capturing light. And that's probably the best use of NDVI because it works well, it's robust from that viewpoint in all of this. And we've been able to compare among seasons, and this is all derived with remote sensing. This is, and we've verified it with ground-based measurements, but we can begin to look at how efficient that light is. We begin to use remote sensing because of a challenge from NASS, looking at separating the vegetative and reproductive phases. When does that plant move from a vegetative stage to reproductive stage? I'll just show you one example. This is M. Cari and O. Savvy. These are two different indices that are out there. We see that we're looking through the season, a lot of bare soil background. We know when that's occurring. It grows up. All of a sudden, the tasseling, that ratio changes and then bops up a little bit again as that tassel matures. So we can pick up tasseling, and that's robust over the whole growing, different growing season. So now we can have a technique of saying, here's the vegetative stage, here's the reproductive stage. And when we trigger that, we can put it into different things, particularly the senescence phase. You know, how rapidly is that plant changing from many different viewpoints? So we've applied, just to give an example, this is the plant senescence reflectance index, and I put that as 1 minus so that 1 is a healthy crop, and then it, as it declines, it goes down. Using that rate of senescence relative to the light interception by the canopy, so the greener I can keep that canopy, the higher the yield. Fortunately, this there's some variation among years. It's not a robust index because there's some water stress. There's a number of different things that are happening in this. So we're working on how do we make this more universal over time from that standpoint. But you can look at the senescence index, and we've been, as that plant starts right after that tasseling stage and starts senescing, we can pick up that slope of that line very quickly, and I can determine when that canopy may be collapsing at the end of the season. This is some work with Anatoly Gittleson where we've actually taken that chlorophyll index and related it back to the gross primary productivity at a large scale, beginning to say, you know, what is that total dynamic of that canopy? And this is a comparison between irrigated and rain-fed maize between Nebraska and Iowa, and looking at that, so where we actually had data. Thermal infrared, where it gets used a lot, is this difference between canopy or leaf temperature and air temperature. Transpiring leaves, and you go back to some of the work by Champ Tanner back in the 60s. That's the original paper that was written on canopy temperatures. And then Wigan, Namkin came in and began to show that. Once we had infrared thermometers, that whole thing exploded in terms of the capabilities of doing that. But they noticed that transpiring leaves were cooler than air. As they became water stressed, they become equal or warmer than air. That led to a whole series of literature that started in the mid-70s with stress degree days, crop water stress index. It's been applied to irrigation scheduling, water use requirements, field variability in terms of looking at water distribution within fields. I mean, the whole aspect of thermal infrared has really become very important. But a lot of questions remain in this puzzle as well, and that is, what's the optimum time interval to collect observations? You know, we have satellites that were locked down. We got 16-day repeat cycles. We got daily repeat cycles. Daily repeat cycles often have very large footprints. They're good for global things, but not necessarily for field things. But you got all this effort that's going on with aircraft and drones, and so the question remains is, when's the best time to collect that data in all of this? So we've been looking at how do we begin to utilize time series to get a more optimum time of data collection. Because we need to ensure that we have georeference data to compare among years. You know, we got to get past this point of the pretty map and get into to much more information content from that standpoint. I'm just going to give you two different indices to look at. I mean, if you're collecting data on NDVI, you know, if we're looking at what's happening in that vegetative growth stage, we may need something at a much more frequent repeat interval. If you're getting in the middle of the season with NDVI, you know, once we know it's 0.85 and that canopy's there, we probably don't need to worry about it until it begins to senesce and we can pick up that index. But if you're in something like this, MCARI or OSABI, in trying to pick up tasseling, we're going to need a much more frequent repeat interval. And so I think that where we're at right now with remote sensing is if we want to really get it into agronomic pieces, is how do we begin to look at the repeat cycle and break that by phenological periods in all of this. Because that's the advantage of aircraft, that's the advantage of the drones, the UAV technology. It's also the advantage of when we start thinking about data platforms from different satellites. How do we begin to utilize this aspect? And I haven't talked about SAR, synthetic aperture radar, where we can peer through clouds, and how do we fuse that with the visible near IR spectrum. So what lessons have we learned? We've learned that we can detect differences among cultivars and treatments when the correct index is used. We can apply these derived values to detect these differences among hybrids. We've done a lot of work looking at genetic variation in this. We can combine in the dynamics of visible and near-infrared shortwave, offer new possibilities. SWIR band, you know, we're just now figuring out what that really means in terms of looking at this. And we believe that now we can separate water and nitrogen stress, looking at those pieces as well. So we've learned a lot. Over the past 40 years, in a lot of cases. In a lot of cases, we're still stuck in using the indices that we've done before, and I think we can go beyond that. But it's going to take a new generation of how do we begin to look at this piece. But I think the utility when we start looking at anything from phenotyping of canopies to a number of different things that go with that, I'm really looking forward to the next 20 or 30 years when we really begin to look at how do we begin to bring even more information content into the data that we have from a number of different viewpoints and how do we plug them back into different systems. So with that, I'll give you enough challenges to think about for careers and everything else. So with that, I'll entertain some questions.